Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. Ellery Queen once said that historical mysteries are the hardest of all mysteries to write. The author we feature in this month's podcast, Marilyn Todd, has made a career of writing such mysteries in time periods ranging from ancient Greece and Rome to America's Old West. Both this year and last, the British author, who has produced more than a dozen critically acclaimed novels, placed in the top three for EQMM's annual Readers Award. Her finalist short story for 2013, The Wickedest Town in the West, is read here by actor Mandy Davis.
My dearest Mary, thank goodness. After weeks of storm-tossed seas, unreliable railroads, and having every bone in my body jarred by the Wells Fargo stagecoach, I have finally reached my destination. Though I confess, dear sister, the town is far from how I envisaged. When my dear, darling Edward wrote of the opportunities that abounded in this booming mining community, my mind pictured a city such as our own, Newcastle-upon-Tyne. A town of shops, theatres, and fine dining establishments. Imagine my shock upon discovering that apart from a few principal thoroughfares, Jerome is little more than a squalid assembly of timber shacks and canvas tents stuck on a hill. That is not all. The buckboard fetching me from Prescott lost a wheel a few miles out of town, and the driver advised against my attempting any climb in this heat. He would walk up, he said, then send someone back to collect me. Well, hardly 5 minutes had passed before a rider approached from the direction in which we had come. Trouble, ma'am? My dear Mary, you've never seen such a ruffian. His high leather boots were covered in dust. His hair fell past his collar, and I doubt he had shaved in 2 days. But by far the most disconcerting part about his appearance was the guns he wore on either side of his hip, slung low and tied to his thigh. "Thank you for asking, but no, sir," I replied. "I have the matter in hand."
"So I see."
He dismounted, studied the broken spoke from the wheel, made what I felt was a far lengthier survey than necessary of my person.
"An English rose won't last long in these temperatures."
He nodded in the direction of that monstrous black brute of his, merrily snickering away in a cactus.
"Hop on up."
In respect of the heat, of course, he was right. My dress, you remember my pale blue afternoon gown with the triple frill skirt? Well, this had already stuck to my skin, for there was little shade in the rough desert scrub. When we left Prescott, I recall the thermometer was reading close to 100, and my corset was biting so tight I could faint. But believe me, I was going nowhere with this vagabond. "A kind offer, sir, which, regretfully, I must refuse. For one thing, I have never sat astride a horse in my life, and for another, I cannot leave my valise unattended.
Those are excuses, not reasons.
Without warning, I found myself picked up as though I was a sack of flour and thrown into the saddle.
There, you are now astride a horse, not so bad, is it? And frankly, unless your luggage grows legs, it's not going anywhere. Let's go."
I was too dizzy from the enormous height at which I'd found myself to object, and if truth be told, I was grateful at not having to spend the next few hours under the fierce Arizona sun with only rattlesnakes and scorpions for company. Alas, my relief was short-lived. Whereas I had been expecting my rescuer to walk alongside, he suddenly swung up behind me, took hold of the reins, and kicked the stallion into a gallop. By the time we reached Jerome, my ringlets were frizz, my throat was parched, and I had never been so personal with a man in my life. And that includes Papa and my darling fiancé.
"The name's Jacob Fuller," he said, lifting me down from the saddle. "Jake to my friends. Welcome to the wickedest town in the West." I'm sure he was teasing, but my knees were too weak from pressing against that horrible horse to stand up, much less care. Mr. Fuller left me at the Trinity Hotel, one of the better structures, and this is where I now pen my letter. The loneliness I wrote of last time has not diminished. I am like a fish out of water in this treeless, lawless, godless land, but crying solves nothing. Tomorrow I shall begin inquiries as to what could have happened to my sweet darling Edward, after which I cannot wait to return home. I shall never again moan about the sweet rains of England or the fog that rolls in from the sea. Give my love to Papa. May God rest you and keep you both safe. Your dear sister, Elizabeth. Dearest Mary, how time passes. It seems barely 2 days since my last letter, never mind 2 weeks, but I am learning, the hard way, that the marking of time is a difficult business in an industry where there is little by way of a regular calendar, and where the hands on even conventional clocks stand at frivolously different angles. I confess I am making poor progress in the matter of dear Edward's disappearance. Part of the problem is that I had gravely underestimated Jerome, not only in size but in the scale of industry that goes on here. The copper mine is the biggest by far, producing over £1 million of copper per month. Per month, Mary! Can you credit it? Then there are the gold and silver mines to be worked, not to mention the vast quantities of zinc and lead that are also extracted. Between the clunking of ore carts and the pound of the stamp mills, there were times when I could hardly make myself heard, assuming anyone could see me through the smoke from the smelting works. Productivity on such a scale means people. Lots of people. I am told by the hotel clerk that over 10,000 souls have flooded into Jerome, and the numbers continue to rise. The town itself is orderly and neat, weaving its way up the mountain, but the camps are unstructured, and many of the men are foreigners with limited knowledge of English. So far I have encountered Germans and Swedes, Irishmen and Scots, 2 Cossacks, many Chinamen, and someone I am told is an Austrian count. Many of these keep irregular hours. Many more of them keep dogs. My search is further hampered by a rather more delicate issue. Mr. Fuller, and it grieves me to write this, was not teasing when he pronounced Jerome the wickedest town in the West. You and I, my dear, seem to be the only 2 people in the universe who are unaware of this fact, but, and again I defer to the hotel clerk's knowledge, the town has no fewer than 37 saloons and 13 bordellos, whereas I have only seen but the 1 church, and that with a door off its hinges. As you know, Edward and I agreed to give our engagement 3 years while he made his fortune out west. However, it occurs to me that if we bring our wedding forward to next year, Edward could use the time to build a small chapel. Then we could revise our plans of spreading God's word in Africa and bring his love to where it is needed the most, in Jerome. Many a time you and I have sat through our dear father's sermons as he raged against Sodom and Gomorrah, but none of them, sweet sister, prepared me for the sights here. Such dens of iniquity you cannot imagine. And I have yet to venture into the district known as the Cribs, where most of the gambling, boozing and bawdy houses are found. Only last night, a girl called Cajun Sue was nearly strangled to death by one of the miners. She only survived because he passed out from the drink. However, unless I find what befell my dear Edward, this is an evil I will not shirk from facing. I only pray it does not come to this, and that I find him safe and well soon. What is particularly distressing is that no one has heard of him, Mary. How can this be so? Mr. Bishop is a carpenter, I tell people, a joiner. For heaven knows there's enough work for such a tradesman. Buildings are going up everywhere that one turns, Raised wooden sidewalks are lining the streets, and mule trains are constantly bringing timbers up to the mines. Yet no matter where I've inquired, I've met with blank faces and shakes of the head. I simply do not understand. Edward may have skipped over some of the less savoury aspects, but he wrote so eloquently about the Arizona sunsets, the mountains, the mines, and the characters he encountered, and how much work there was for him in Jerome, that I do not doubt for a second he was here. It is, of course, a mystery that I shall get to the bottom of, however long it may take. By the way, I had another encounter with the unmentionable Mr. Fuller. This was yesterday evening, and although his boots were no longer covered with dust, it seems he has retained his aversion to barbers. "If you're going to continue traipsing round factories and mines," he said, not even bothering to remove his hat, but merely tipping the brim with his finger, "I suggest you ditch those heavy petticoats and that corset of yours before you poach to death up there in the hills." You see, Mary, exactly the kind of vulgarity my dear Edward was protecting me from. "Mind telling me exactly what it is that you're after?" "I most certainly do mind, Mr. Fuller." A lady does not discuss business with any gentleman who considers undergarments to be an appropriate topic of conversation, especially when they are hers. "Incidentally, please don't mention the fist fights, opium dens, and brothels to Papa. He will only worry himself silly. Tell him I am in excellent health, which is true, and that I am thoroughly enjoying my sojourn in the West. The latter may be a falsehood, but it is only a small one, and as far as Papa is concerned, it's for the best. I know he feels I'm on a fool's errand, that Edward has simply found a new love and has been too cowardly to write me. But I know this is not true. His last letter was every bit as affectionate as the 20 before it. He would not have broken our engagement without honour. With luck and God's blessing, I will still be home before All Saints. Your ever-loving sister, Elizabeth. P.S. I almost forgot. A week ago, I had the most unimaginable toothache and asked one of the miners, an old-timer rejoicing in the name of Turkey Creek Jones, how I might find relief. "Your best bet's the Lone Star Saloon," he told me. "Ask for John Henry. You'll find him dealing faro, most like." The Lone Star does not enjoy the most salubrious reputation, but at least it is not in the cribs. Also, with my mouth swollen and exceedingly painful, I had little choice in the matter. Even so, you can imagine how my heart thumped as I approached the double swing doors. The smell of rye whiskey almost overpowered me as I entered, as did the smoke from the cheroots. "Excuse me, I'm looking for the dentist, John Henry." My request was greeted with a series of whistles and catcalls loud enough to waken the dead, not to mention a set of old-fashioned looks from the saloon girls, who, I might add, look quite delightful in their brightly coloured ruffles and feathers. To my surprise, a handsome young man, well-dressed, with a neat moustache and slightly asymmetrical eyes, quietened the crowd with his hand. "I am John Henry," he coughed. "How may I help, ma'am?" I explained about the toothache, trying my best not to stare at the pistol concealed beneath his long broadcloth coat. "Come with me," he said kindly. "I'll see what I can do. Meanwhile, if any of you gentlemen," he added over his shoulder, "take so much as a peek at my cards while I'm gone, you might want to send for a priest." The hush that settled over the saloon suggested that the young dentist wasn't joking. But strangely, Mary, I did not feel ill at ease. Even when he led me up to his room in the hotel across the street and laid out his instruments on the dresser, I felt in capable hands.
"Open wide."
I opened wide.
"Say ah."
I said ah.
"Abscess," he pronounced after prodding and probing until my eyes watered. "Gargle with salt water 4 times a day, and within a week you'll be righter than rain."
I thanked him warmly and asked how much I owed him. He coughed again, this time so hard that his face grew quite pale from the effort.
"See these clothes? This fine handgun?" He uncapped a small bottle of laudanum and sipped. I've earned these, and more, through the proceeds of blackjack and poker. I can't in all conscience take money from you, especially when the only thing I've done is diagnose the obvious. He bowed. No charge for today's services, ma'am. How refreshing, I thought, to be dealing with the only true gentleman I had met since my arrival. When I emerged from the hotel, would you believe there was none other than Jacob Fuller leaning against the wall, grinning from one side of his face to another? Well, well, there it was again, that insolent tip of the hat-brim. Who'd have expected an English rose to be in the same bed as a thorn bush? I have a toothache, I said crossly. I needed a dentist. Lang Howe is the best doc in town. He's reasonably priced, offers good Chinese medicine, and doesn't shoot holes in his patients. I bib consult who I like, and if you don't mind, I whip stick with John Henry. Then you'd best get better or worse by tomorrow, he laughed. John Henry Holliday's headed east at first light for Tombstone to join Wyatt Earp.
Dear Mary, how wonderful to hear from you. I am so glad your sewing is improving and that you are enjoying your work with the choir. I confess, it quite made my heart ache reading how the ladies of the church miss me as much as I miss them, especially Miss Bunce. Such a meek, gentle creature, and I swear no one bakes seed cake quite like her. Have I written about the food here? The Mexican influence is strong in the camp, and the spices take some getting used to. But once one has embraced the fiery blends, the palate finds most other foods bland, and those floury tortillas crisped up on the griddle are scrumptious. In addition, a wealth of foreign influence abounds, and who would have thought Danish sausages could taste so different from German sausages, eh? In particular, my friend Jaya Lee, whose father, Lang Howe, the doctor who also owns the laundry, conjures up some truly magical dinners in her round metal pot. What is amazing is that she produces them in next to no time. Also, I cannot be sure whether I told you that I moved out of the Trinity Hotel. Partly, this was because the red floral wallpaper with its tasteless blue frieze grated my nerves. Partly because the establishment was running expensive, and my funds need to stretch further than my initial budget, although I still hope to be home with you by Christmas. But mainly, it's because I found the atmosphere stuffy and dull. The little bald clerk with his striped vest and gold pocket watch had perspiration in abundance, but no conversation. And there were times when I could scream at the constant tick, tick, tick of the clock in the lobby, especially when it's permanently set at the incorrect time. Consequently, I have removed to rooms adjacent to the Chinese laundry, and you've never seen such a hive of industry in your life. How they cope with the heat from the wood-fired boiler that is constantly burning is beyond me. I suppose they get shade from the drying platforms in the backyard where the wet clothes are hung, but on the whole I find the place very festive. The front of the premises is painted in red with black lettering and the most glorious symbols you have ever clapped eyes on, and often Turkey Creek Jones and I drink tea with Jaya Lee and her father from dainty porcelain cups without handles. Imagine, no handles! There is, of course, a certain irony in seeing men beavering away at the washtubs and scrubboards, when such a notion is unheard of in China, this being women's work there. But then they don't use starch in the Orient either. Lang Howe says more of his countrymen will be flooding to this corner of Arizona soon to help build the railroad that is planned for next year. Apart from Turkey Creek and Jaya Lee, my other good friend is Mrs. Brown, known to all and sundry as Butter. I met her about a week into my stay, when one of Moondog Kelly's puppies broke loose, and he and I were trying to recapture it before it ran under a cartwheel or got kicked by a mule. As I turned the corner, I cannoned into Mrs. Brown, sending her flying backwards into the dirt,
then compounded the felony by landing smack bang on top of the poor woman. I felt sure she would be furious. Remember Miss Tyndall, when all I did was step on her toe? No such tirade from Butter, whose trademark saying is legendary. I ain't much to look at, boys, but wait till you see my gals. You're gonna love me then. Despite running a house of ill repute and having a talent for drinking most men under the table, a warmer, funnier soul you could not hope to meet. Believe it or not, it was on the opening night of her establishment that the famous encounter between Wyatt Earp and Billy the Kid took place. Apparently, Mr. Earp was more interested in how the town was shaping up than romance, while over by the bar, a young man she'd never seen before had the miners in stitches with his jokes and tall tales. He was of small build and rather strange-looking, she remembered, but in spite of his joviality and charm, she had this feeling that you wouldn't want to get on his bad side. The other thing was that both his holsters faced backwards. After an hour or so, the boy sauntered over to where Butter and Wyatt were drinking. "City dude like you," he said, indicating Mr. Earp's sharp suit and neat grooming. "Kinda out of place here, ain't you?"
"On my way to Tombstone, son, to join my family."
"Henry McCarty," the boy said, offering his hands. "My friends call me Billy. You know, I saw you in Dodge a while back."
"Did you now?"
"Watched you down four drunk drovers in the middle of the town, and I swear I ain't never seen anyone draw nor shoot so fast in my life."
Mr. Earp said nothing, just put down his glass.
"Which made me wonder," the boy said, grinning, "who's the fastest, do you reckon? Wyatt Earp or Billy the Kid?"
"You don't have to do this, son," Mr. Earp said. And who knows what would have happened next, because suddenly there was shooting and yelping outside in the street, where a dozen war-painted Apaches were herding the horses out of the corral, firing wildly into the night.
Mr. Earp was at the door taking aim with his pistol when he felt a Colt pressed to his ear.
"I'll be relieving you of that," Billy said politely. "Sorry we never got to finish our chat, but I got to get these nags to New Mexico pronto. Maybe I'll look you up in Tombstone on the way back, though. How'd that be?"
"Be my pleasure, Henry."
"Billy," he said, jumping into the saddle. "Told you, my friends call me Billy." Butter makes no bones about her plain looks, or the fact that there is no Mr. Brown, and has a laugh that would not be out of place in the livery stables. But she's fair, shrewd, generous to a fault, and it was she who found me these lodgings above the Palace Saloon and negotiated a rock-bottom price for my stay. What she failed to mention, however, and which I only discovered after I had installed my belongings, is that the saloon belongs to Jacob Fuller. "Once again, Mary, I implore you not to tell Papa about Butter's occupation or my change of address for the effect it will have on his health. But I have learned not to judge either the miners who frequent Butter's premises, and others like them, or the girls employed there. When you see the tough life these men have to endure in their ramshackle tents without water or light, you understand why they take comfort in women and whiskey, especially on cold desert nights. There are few luxuries here, to be sure. Some of the miners have been quite enterprising, running a 2-inch pipe down from the creek and catching the water in a large metal system. In fact, it is proving to be so popular that others are talking about following suit. What next, I ask? A bathhouse here in Jerome? Incidentally, I found my heavy old day dress is too hot for this climate, whereas muslin is light and most pleasing. Also, don't tell anyone, but I have decided to abandon my petticoats and corsets until I return to civilization. Too impractical out here for words. You ask about Edward, and I have good news, though once again, wouldn't you know it, it was Jacob, Mr. Fuller, who shed light on the matter.
"Small wonder you're getting nowhere," he said, after Butter told him why I'd been traipsing round the mines these past weeks. "You've been asking the wrong question. In fact, if he hadn't been so damn stubborn, I could have told you at the outset, my dear Elizabeth, that the person you should have been asking about is Pinebox Ted."
I was so busy telling him that I was not his anything, much less a dear one, and that in future, if he wished to address me, it would be as Miss Sheridan or nothing at all, that I didn't catch on straight away. Who's Pine Box Ted?
Your fiancé, didn't he tell you?
Hardly anyone in the West used their own name, he explained, because if everyone answered to John, William or Henry when they were called, there'd be a stampede.
Some narrow the list by calling themselves Jack, Bill or Hank, but that still leaves too many for comfort. So they become Curly Jim Carter, Kentucky Jack, Doc Holliday.
John Henry Holliday, dentist turned gambler turned gunfighter, very good at all three.
Edward, Ted, I understand that, though his poor mother would turn in her grave. But where does the pine box come in? Edward is a carpenter, a joiner.
An undertaker, he said. He didn't mention that either?
Well, if it's any consolation, he's a good one.
He paused, stuck his tongue in the side of his cheek. Course, he's had plenty of practice.
I didn't doubt that. Time and again during my month in Jerome, I have followed North Road to the cemetery up at the end in search of a quiet knoll on which to sit. Here I contemplate the flat basin and soaring red rocks beyond, listening to the breeze shiver the needles of the ponderosa pine, smell the vanilla scent of its bark, and watch wild peccaries, which are like pigs, root around for berries and worms. And every time I look at the wrought iron railings, the wobbly crosses, and wind-worn tombstones, I am humbled by the number of mining accidents that befell these brave pioneers, not to mention those who met a bloodier and more violent end. Never once, though, did it cross my mind that Edward might be responsible for building their coffins and giving them peace in a land they were otherwise unable to tame. Why has no one thought fit to mention that the town undertaker is missing?
Maybe because nobody's died. Jacob, that is, Mr. Fuller, removed his hat and dusted it against his thigh.
What you need to understand, Elizabeth, is that drifters and drovers pass through Jerome all the time. Men looking for fortunes, men running from the law. Some find what they're seeking, most don't.
He put a match to the lamp, which cast a pleasing glow over the room and showed the blue wallpaper in a very kind light. It also glinted on the pistols either side of his hip.
Your man could be dead, married, in jail, for all I know. Same thing in my book.
Heathen. Has anyone checked inside Ted's workshop? I asked. A tradesman might well tire of a town and move on, but he will never leave his tools behind.
No idea. Like I said, people come and go all the time. No big deal.
I think he saw the tears that welled in my eyes.
The sun's going down, he said. It's too late tonight, but tomorrow, if you'd care, we could go take a look.
Dear Mary, I cannot tell you how nervous I am. After weeks of travelling, searching, hoping and waiting, I am scared at what I might find in the morning. I know I will not sleep a wink. With fondest love and my warmest affection, your beloved sister, Elizabeth.
Heavens, Mary, there is so much to tell you, I don't know where to begin. Yesterday I saw a man killed. It was awful. After 5 weeks, I have almost grown accustomed to the brawls that are such a feature of this godforsaken town. I cannot criticise the men, Mary. They work hard down in the mines in the most appalling conditions, or else sweat their guts, hearts out in the factories and workshops, while yet others spend weeks at a time in the hills, scraping, digging, panning and hoping, living off wild rabbits and quail. When they want to let off steam, there are many, too many, unscrupulous folk looking to separate them from their hard-earned nuggets and cash. Consequently, tempers run high. There are fights over cheating, fights over women, fights over nothing at all. Something as trivial as having tobacco spat on their boots can flare into a feud in which arms then get broken, shots fired and knives are pulled and frequently used.
Why don't soldiers patrol the streets and keep order? I asked Jacob, Mr. Fuller, the day Rotgut Rogers was stretchered off on a tabletop, his neck and sides streaming with blood. Fort Verde is only 30 miles distant. The soldiers are tasked with keeping a lid on any Indian uprisings and protecting the settlers, though we did have a frontier marshal here once. Lasted 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even a month, before he ran off and married one of Butter Brown's whores. Keeps a pig farm in Kansas, I hear. He makes these things up to annoy me.
So, who keeps the peace?
These. He patted the guns at his hip. These keep the peace, Lizzie, and mighty effective they are.
Faster than lightning, he emptied both barrels into the sign that read Palace Saloon, or rather, Ace Loon, after he'd finished.
Long overdue a new sign, he said, holstering his weapons. What do you reckon? Red, white and blue, all patriotic, or black and gold to look classy?
What I reckon, Mr. Fuller, is that you do not call me Lizzie again unless you wish to walk with a limp. My point, Mary, that the absence of peacekeepers allows the brutishness to go unchecked, for without doubt this is a dangerous town. Liquored up miners run on very short fuses. Steep streets and sharp corners make a perfect ambush for robbery. The town still talks of a woman called Jane who had acid thrown in her face by a fellow prostitute who accused her of stealing her clients. But as disturbing as they are, most outbreaks of violence stem from hot-headedness rather than malice. However, there is a man, a Frenchman, by the name of Lacasse, who is as mean as a rattlesnake and vicious to boot. He sells liquor to the Apaches and then, when they're drunk, plays on their fears of the white man. With their hunting lands displaced by the mines, they already make a nuisance of themselves, raiding the farmlands for food. But the Frenchman's poison dripping into their ears incites them to commit far worse crimes. That in itself is despicable enough, but it is not how Lacasse makes his living. After the settlers leave, either having been driven out or butchered, Lacasse puts in a claim for their land. Many, including several government officials, consider him the prime source of the current Indian troubles, but either way, he is not popular in these parts. Yesterday, he happened to be passing through on his way south to Phoenix, when he was recognized by the son of one of the farmers. The boy, 16 at most, called him a murderer, a coward, a thief and a cheat, and challenged him to a duel. Gunfights are not unheard of here either. Happily, most of the protagonists are too drunk to aim true, and the bullets end up splintering the blacksmiths, spraying the wheelwrights, or else peppering the general store. On one occasion, they even lodged in Moondog Kelly's saddlebag. This had a different feel. Lacasse stood up, stretched. "Why not?" he said, as though he found the challenge amusing. "Why the hell not, mon ami?" Then he followed the boy out of the Silver Nugget Saloon and shot him 4 times in the back. How often have you and I comforted the sick and dying with Papa, reading to his parishioners from the Bible, holding their hands and stroking their hair. None of that, Mary, compares with cold-blooded murder. Lacasse returned to the saloon, finished his drink, then rode out of town as though nothing had happened, leaving the boy with his liver, kidneys and backbone blown out, bleeding to death on the street. For obvious reasons, the horror of this episode has eclipsed my news regarding Edward's disappearance. But on this I'm pleased to report a certain progress. Jacob Fuller, that is, accompanied me to the undertaker's workshop next morning as promised, and I won't deny my nerves were in tatters. Could he, like the frontier marshal, have run away with one of Butter Brown's whores to raise pigs up in Kansas? Worse, suppose the workshop was wide open and remained full of his tools, where he'd been robbed and murdered in his bed. My imagination ran wild, my fears worse. Yet none of these scenarios had taken place, if the padlock on the door was anything to go by.
"Looks like our undertaker left with every intention of coming back," Jacob said upon prizing the lock. "There's 6 coffins out back which smacks of a stockpile to me, while his tools are as neatly laid out as his customers, every bit as well oiled as well." I was in no mood for humour.
"Then where is he? 3 months passed in England without my receiving a letter, and this from a man who wrote every week. When you add on the length of my journey, the time I've been here—"
"Look around, Sheridan, what do you see?"
I see dust. Lots of dust. But then in a community that revolves around stripping every mineral it can find out of these mountains, that is exactly what I'd expect.
All right then, what don't you see?
Sometimes, Mary, I think Jim Bean and Jake Fuller see rather too much of each other. What are you driving at?
We've had a good old poke around the place, right? Do you see any money, cooking utensils, blankets? There isn't even the bundle of letters you wrote him.
He could have burned them.
Indeed, he paused, though it doesn't explain why he took his writing equipment with him.
I had hoped to find answers inside the workshop. Instead, I found more and more questions. Edward hasn't skipped town. He hasn't moved on, and he didn't simply go off for a picnic and never come back. Indeed, the whole business made me so uneasy my stomach started to hurt. And whether it was the 3 shots of bourbon I drank to help settle it, or the thought of Edward all alone in the hills with my letters under his pillow while he penned his undying affection, I don't know. But I did the only sensible I could think of, dear sister. I promptly burst into tears.
We'll find him, Sheridan. We just need to ask around, find out who his friends were, what he was planning, because someone somewhere will know. Jake grinned. Someone somewhere always does.
The plan cheered me, and I threw myself wholeheartedly into the venture, visiting various barber shops, hardware stores, cat houses and saloons, and came up with absolutely nothing. Was I surprised? Edward has always played things close to his chest, and so, yes, I was disappointed. Yes, I was sad. And yes, I was back at square one. But I was not remotely surprised. Perhaps it was because he was orphaned so young. Perhaps it is our famous English reserve. Perhaps it's because he's the undertaker that kept folk at arm's length. Either way, he has no close friends in Jerome, that's for sure, and it fair breaks my heart that Pinebox Edward, call him what you will, has been gone for so long, yet nobody noticed. Oh, and my other news is that Turkey Creek Jones has asked Jaya Lee to marry him, and they will be wed on Thursday next week. We are all very excited at the prospect of a Chinese wedding, especially as we have no idea what it entails. Jaya Lee calls herself Julie these days. It's what TC's always called her, though not intentionally. And they will be moving to a cabin not far from town, close to where the railway will pass. He is, of course, much older than her, nearly 50, and has been married before. Indeed, there is some dispute that the marriage has ended, but he is strong and fit and will make a good husband. He also has most of his teeth. Fondest love, Elizabeth.
Goodness, Mary, it's been so long since I wrote. I'm sorry if I worried you, dear. The thing is, I've been scouring the hills, searching for Ted, out of my mind about what might have happened. I haven't travelled halfway around the world to give up now, I announced after Jaya Lee and TCJ's wedding. Which was a jolly affair, by the way, with the bride dressed in red and something that looked like an Indian headdress over her hair, except it was covered with bobbles. We ate sucking pig and duck, also some sticky round dumplings, but while the men formed a dragon and danced through the camp, my mind feared for the trials ahead. Not so much the coyotes. My aim with a stone is pretty good now, and rattlesnakes are harmless providing you leave them alone. But there are spiders out here the size of your hand, and the very thought of them makes me ill. I can't just sit around biting my nails, I said. I'm going to look for him. Moondog insisted on coming along.
You need a tracker, he said, though I didn't.
Anna, doctor, Langhow said, wagging a forceful finger, in case you fall off horse or big spider bite.
I know the terrain out there like the back of my hand, said Turkey Creek Jones. I'm coming too.
Absolutely not, I protested. You're on your honeymoon.
No, he go, Jaya Lee said firmly. We both go. Give me nice break from cooking.
Butter slapped her thigh, saying something along the lines of, hell now, this is one honeymoon she wouldn't miss for the world. While Jake shook his head at the absurdity of it all, but told me to count him in anyway.
Never know when you need a peacemaker, he murmured, quietly oiling his pistols.
Peacemaker or undertaker, I wondered. For Edward to have been absent so long without sending word, my heart feared for his safety.
But my word, Mary, this is a wonderful country.
One minute we are passing through gorges of red rock and oak, the next we are on windswept mesas picking our way past mesquite and cactus, watching dust storms spiral then fall. Surprisingly, several creeks still flow this time of year, and those which cross the spoil piles run turquoise from the spent copper ore. Mule deer and jackrabbits scamper at the sound of our hooves, red-tailed hawks soar in the cloudless blue sky, and the nights are clear and full of stars. As our little group weaved its way from claim to claim, we began to hear whisperings that an old prospector, known as Conquistador Sam, had died and left Edward his claim.
"Why would he do a thing like that?" Moondog asked.
Butter snapped her fingers. "I know. Heidi told Lily, who'd heard it from Cuban Kate, that when Pinebox was first headed into Jerome, he was passing one of them big red pillars of rock when he heard yelling and cussing in equal measures, I gather, but that ain't the point." She let out her big horsey laugh. "Apparently, Sam's mule had upped and died on the spot, trapping the old man's leg when it fell. Pinebox heard the commotion and went across to investigate. Sam credited him with saving his life."
And so it was, my dear Mary, that the very next morning we tracked him down, and I found myself face to face with Edward Bishop at last. At first he was hacking so feverishly with his pickaxe that he did not hear us approach. Then he turned, and my heart gave a leap. Oh, Edward! As tall and as broad as ever, with his sandy hair falling over his forehead, like when we used to walk by the river, or pore over plans for our future. I imagined he'd be shocked, scandalized even, by hair that was no longer in beautiful ringlets, but tied back in a comfortable bun, by the gaucho pants I wore in place of a dress, or my coolie hat to keep out the sun. Instead, he barely stopped work, other than to squeeze both my hands and apologize for the worry he had caused me.
"I have written, my dearest, every week, I assure you, only I have not been in a position to include them in the mailbags that leave on the stage."
I did not understand. Surely he needed food and supplies. Why not post the letters at the same time?
"I rely on other miners to fetch me whatever I need," Edward said between blows. "But I would not risk handing over my outpourings of affection to any one of these rogues, and it is imperative I find the seam the old man talked of. Nothing else matters, you see."
"Oh, dear. You know why they called him Conquistador, don't you?"
"After the Spaniards that came here looking for gold, they saw the copper jewelry the Yavapai wore, thought El Dorado might be in these parts as well, never found it, so they moved on."
"Yes, but
exactly, my darling. There is gold."
His big blue eyes shone.
"Men are mining it, sluicing it, panning it and dredging it from California to the Mexican border. More importantly, there's gold in these mountains, and the old man found it as well." He tapped the rock with his knuckles. "Right here, in this very hillside."
"But that's what I'm trying to... Edward, would you please put that pick down for a moment?"
"Can't stop, dearest. The quicker I find this seam, the quicker I can get home. God, how I hate this terrible place. The vile, stinking heat, the bitter cold nights, the scorpions, the vultures."
"Really? Your letters positively brimmed with affection for the area. You wrote of fiery sunsets, sweet water creeks, the quirky characters that you encountered.
I would not have you worry, Elizabeth.
But now you are here, you can see for yourself. Arizona is a barren abomination without charm. Jerome infested with the spawn of the devil. Harlots, killers, drunkards and thieves. There is no law and no respect. Did you know the townsfolk refused to address me as Mr. Bishop? Not even Edward. It was Ted. Then they added insult to injury by sticking Pinebox in front because I built coffins."
"Like mother, like son," I thought.
"And poor you," he wailed. "Words fail me that you were forced to rely on a gaggle of degenerates to track me."
He nodded towards the group gathered around the mouth of the mine.
"Apaches, harlots, low-down barkeepers."
"Half Apache," Moondog corrected. "My father was Irish."
"Edward," I held up my hand. "Sam was called Conquistador
because he stumbled across some old Spanish breastplates and a couple of helmets half buried at the foot of these rocks. Somehow he got it into his head that they'd abandoned their steel armour for new sets made out of gold.
"That old man was crazier than a one-legged coyote,"
TCJ snorted.
"You're wrong, darling, quite wrong. When I pulled that dead mule off his leg, all he could talk about were the rich veins of gold that run through this mountain."
"Then where is it?" I asked. "If the old man was right and this claim is indeed wall-to-wall gold, how come he hadn't found a single nugget in 17 years? The penny dropped. He looked from face to face, then back at me.
"No gold?"
The pickaxe fell from his hand as though it was fire.
"It can't be. I need that gold to get away from this hellhole so we can marry and live the life that we wanted."
It seemed such a jolly adventure back home in England. Edward worrying that because I came from a good family, marriage to a joiner was beneath me. As you know, Mary, I did not share his anxiety. To create masterpieces with one's hands is surely God's calling, but I understood his pride to want to make his fortune, and all men need to slay dragons when they are young. The West seemed the perfect opportunity for both. "That is the reason I tracked you down," I swallowed. "I have come to break off our engagement."
"Is this one of your wheezes?"
I held out my ring. "I have never had wheezes, Edward."
"So, no gold and no marriage?"
He rubbed his hands over a face that had turned whiter than any of Langhow's sheets.
"Oh, dear Lord, I killed him for nothing."
For half a minute, there was only the sound of the wind.
"What did you say?" I didn't. I was joking. I mean, all this effort for nothing. I told you the old man died of a fever, left me the claim in his will."
"Where is it?" This was the first time my Jake had spoken.
"I don't know. Here, somewhere. Maybe it got blown away in the wind. You know how a breeze suddenly whips up out of nowhere?
That cairn his grave marker?" At Jake's signal, Moondog, Lang Howe and Turkey Creek Jones picked up shovels and started to dig. He himself remained motionless, though, hands loose at his hips.
"This is sacrilege," Edward protested. "In any case, the old man died months ago. There's nothing to see after all this."
"You wrong, look." Lang Howe pointed into the pit in which the body had been mummified by the sand.
"Bullet hole." "He shot himself. Accidentally. That's how he ended up dying of fever. The wound festered."
"Hard to accidentally shoot yourself 3 times, isn't it?" Jake asked.
And I knew he was hoping Edward would reach for his Winchester rifle, but he didn't. He fell to his knees and sobbed like a child, and what a sorry bunch we were as we made our way home. I do feel responsible for this tragedy, Mary, at least in part. Sometimes I wish I hadn't crossed the ocean at all, stayed at home with you and Papa, in ignorant bliss. Or maybe if I'd just hung around in Jerome until he came back for his tools. Good or bad, though, one can't rewrite the past. And now Edward Bishop languishes in Prescott Jail, awaiting trial for murder. I am hoping his lawyer will use gold fever as his defence, though I fear the judge will view things differently. Insanity might well be the effect. It certainly wasn't the cause. As for me, I have decided that Jerome is my home, and not purely because it's where my heart is. I wrote earlier how, with its opium dens, brothels, saloons and casinos, this is the wickedest town in the West, and only the one church that I've seen. With the railroad coming next year, things will only get worse, with more miners losing more than they can earn on card tables, women and whiskey, rather than spending it wisely on food and supplies. I cannot stand idly by while this happens. With the money I raised from the Spanish breastplates and helmets, Toledo steel fetches a high price, I have bought a plot of land beside the area earmarked for the station.
Here I shall open my Rawhide Steakhouse, making sure every customer gets a square meal. And who knows, if the venture is successful, I might open a Rawhide Steakhouse in every town linked by the railway. Give my love to Papa and sweet little Miss Bunce, your loving sister and Jake.
The Wickedest Town in the West is copyrighted by Marilyn Todd. Music for the podcast is by Tom Joad and was obtained through the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.